welcome back to the Lumieres podcast with me, Jody White. And it's a wonderful sunny day on the south coast of England. Feels like summer is here already, which is great. We're having a bit of a heat wave, 22 degrees today. Whew, in my shorts for the first time. Well, that's not strictly true. I was in my shorts this very weekend, just gone, as I went to the first festival of the year, which was fantastic. My friends Phil and Lynn Callie-Jones, who are based around Tenterden in Kent. They're drum makers, amongst other things. And they put on their first micro festival this weekend, just gone, which was held at Hole Park in Rolvedon. And it's called Roots Gathering. And you can find it on Facebook. There's a group, Roots Gathering group. And it was just beautiful. It was such a lovely event. Can't have been more than a couple of hundred people in this beautiful setting with magnificent big old trees surrounding it. They had music and workshops and talks, and it was just so relaxed and so inclusive. And what I really noticed is the lack of kind of trying to be some sort of spiritual event. It was just honest and genuine and open, and you know, everyone came from a different place and brought their own flavor to the event. And yeah, it was just wonderful. So I'd highly recommend checking that out, joining the group, and keeping an eye out for that coming up next year, because I think it's just going to go from strength to strength. And I was invited to share a fermentation workshop there, which was fantastic. Really enjoyed myself sharing my knowledge about kombucha and how to make sauerkraut and kefir and kimchi and the benefits of fermentation on the mind and body, which is something I can go on about for quite a while at ease. So it was great to do a workshop, and I think it'll be the first of many in that space for me. So that was a great experience. Got my shorts out, lovely weather, had a listen to some beautiful music, and above all just reconnected with being outside and being in my body and having bare feet on the soil, which sounds like a simple thing, but you know, when you're working and you've got a busy week and you're spend most of your time focused in your head. So planting your bare feet on the earth and running around on the grass and meeting some great people and having some conversations, and it's just so good for the soul, you know, it's medicine for the soul. And I came away feeling really grounded and happy, and had a great time. And one of the discoveries of the weekend was there was some music on the first evening on Friday night, and the lady who was playing was called Kelly Bourne. She played a lovely set. She got a great voice. And then she had to dash off, and she came back to the tent to introduce us to a young lady she'd met around the fire while she just was on her break from her two sets. And she'd asked her to step up and play. So this lady, her name is Sibby. She got up and played. She hadn't played for a while. She was a little bit nervous. She sat down and began to play, and she began to sing. And her voice, just blew everybody away. She immediately got everyone's attention. Beautiful acoustic songs. She's got this kind of soul voice with a wonderful amount of control. Just perfect tone. It's so lovely, and it matches with the acoustic guitars beautifully. And I'm going to play, she's been kind enough to let me play a track of hers. And my guest today is Carolyn Cowan, who, she's a force of nature, is Carolyn. I was so happy to get to meet her and to have a chat and sit down. And we'd been going back and forwards trying to organize it for maybe a month or so. She's a busy lady, and I was really pleased that she made time to chat with me and sit down, and we had a great wide-ranging conversation covering all sorts of things about her life and career. And she's primarily known as I came to her as a Kundalini yoga teacher. She runs specialist workshops for pregnant mothers. She does work with addiction and shame. She's a qualified psychosexual therapist. Before all that, she was a photographer. She's been a body painter. She used to work in the music industry on pop videos in the 80s. And she talks about that life and that transition from this kind of crazy life that she was leading in the 80s, where something had to shift, something had to change, to the clean and sober life she's led for the last 20 odd years. as a teacher, a therapist, and she's got stories, she's entertaining, she's a warm presence, she's outspoken, she's a bit of a rebel, and I think you're going to enjoy this one. I certainly had a great time chatting to her. If you want to check out what she does, her website is www.carolyncowan.com. That's CarolynCowan.com. And you can find out all the things she does there. She's got a popular YouTube channel with some of her yoga teaching on there. Wonderful lady. Thank you again, Carolyn, for sitting down with me. I do hope you guys enjoy the chat. And before we go into that, as promised, I will play you this gorgeous song by Sibby. You can find her music on, she's got a little Bandcamp page, which is sybie.bandcamp.com. And I think if you search her on Facebook as well, she has a musical page. And I think she really deserves to go further with this talent. She will. It's a question of when, really, not if. She's clearly blessed with a beautiful voice, a beautiful songwriting skills. And you'll see what I mean when you've listened to this track. I mean, she had the whole tent enraptured at Roots Gathering this weekend in the palm of her hand, really. So thank you once again, Sibby, for letting me spread the word of your glorious music. And please check her out. I'm sure she'll be popping up here and there around the summer. But I think this lady's going to go far. So you heard it here first. Or maybe not. But anyway. This is entitled Stars, and this is by Sibby.
So many moments have passed in many beautiful places, woken up every morning to see beautiful faces. Been surrounded by wonderful souls. Well, it's only been weeks, but it feels like years. There's been laughter and love, smiles and tears. No, the memories, they never go. Some go, some stay, but at the end of the day, we'll all go our own way, get back on the road again. Got to let go. Don't be sad that it's over, but be happy that it happened. So I'll see you in the loop, my friend. You know this journey, no, it never ends. Round and round and round and round and round and round we go, until we spiral up and out. Until we spiral up and out again. We go back to the stars, the stars, the stars. We go. You are a star. So strong you are.
So first of all, I just want to say thank you for making time to do this and speak and meet. And
it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. You too. And I've been aware of your work on and off for maybe 2 or 3 years. And I came to it through my own practices and investigations I've been doing into yoga and specifically Kundalini variations over the last sort of 10 years or so. And I really appreciated what you brought to the table in that respect. And I remember looking at some of your content, your videos, and the way that you bring yourself to it was very different to a lot of the other people who were involved in that scene.
Is it, in what way is it different?
Well, for me, you stood out as you have a bit of a rebel air about you. And that's something that I'm quite attracted to, because I think those kind of people are usually very... there's a lot of stories and there's a lot of interest, and there's perhaps been stuff in the person's history or in the person's past that's brought them to where they are and why they have that kind of air or attitude. You know, that was my perception when I first kind of saw your work, which I hadn't experienced that angle on it from the people in that community up to that point.
Right.
It was great. My experience of it was fantastic and it took me to some great places, but there was something that felt slightly dogmatic sometimes in those circles. So I was really...
You mean outside of what I teach? You mean there's a dogma outside of how
it
I
was
teach.
A perception that I came to after doing that practice for a number of years within certain teachers and certain...
Right. So, and then you're saying that what you saw of
and
me
and what
was...
I saw in you was something coming at it from a different place.
Yeah.
And I really appreciated that because I felt like it was really refreshing to kind of... There's a lot of other influences going on and maybe things that other people in that scene would not bring. So I really appreciate that. And I wonder if you can maybe you could talk a little bit to start off with about how you came to yoga and your you know, the beginnings of your journey into yoga.
I remember in the late 80s, early 90s, knowing that things weren't going well.
In what sense were things
knowing
weren't going
that
well?
My response to my history, my reaction to my story, how I'd internalized my experiences of life and how I was then reacting to that was not actually really working for me anymore. And I can say it in that way with a lot of hindsight, but I think at the time that wasn't how I felt. But I knew that things were not as they should be and I was not doing it right. I knew that it was not a happy time. And I remember my first spiritual teacher was a woman, a very interesting woman called Ritasha.
Ritasha.
Yeah, she then became Mother Ritasha. And when I first met her, she was called Ricky, and then she was called Ritasha, and then she was called Mother Ritasha. And I met her when I was 18, but when I was 31, I knew I was crashing, and I knew it wasn't good. And I had a really serious drug and alcohol problem, and I knew that I needed to do something different. And it's kind of interesting that I went to her rather than a doctor. And I would go, and I went through a phase of not drinking, and I would go and see her for kind of spiritual classes, in inverted commas, in Ebury Street, interestingly, in Belgravia, every day for a period of time at about 5 o'clock in the morning. And I'd sit with her in this room with this amazing cold light. And she would talk to me about the mind and the relationship with the divine. And it was an extraordinary time. And I still remember it vividly. And I know that for me it was a very, very, it was a time that created a huge shift in me. And then gradually my drinking got worse, my drug taking got worse. And then I really did crash. And I stopped drinking and smoking and gambling in 1991.
You were gambling as well?
Yeah, I was gambling as well.
Wow.
There's a piece of weblog, actually, on my weblog about what was in my handbag when I got sober.
Okay, do you want to share that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a piece of public weblog. Yeah. I was in Ireland, actually, when I got sober. I was working on a pop video, and I had smuggled cocaine and hash and a flick knife and two hip flasks. Well, the hip flasks weren't really a smuggle, but... And I had my handbag, had a flick knife, a roll of poker dice, two hip flasks full... a wrap of cocaine and a lump of hash.
What was the purpose of the flick knife?
Because
defense.
Not everybody's nice, darling. Especially not when you're doing that kind of thing. I mean,
I wouldn't
you
if it was a tool.
Here,
a tool of
No. And I think the thing about getting sober that was really interesting is I got taken to my first 12-step meeting in Dublin, in Ireland, and it was a bit of a life-changing experience. And there and then I stopped drinking, smoking and taking drugs.
Within that program?
But in that day, that day.
Really?
I handed all my drugs over to another member of the band. And actually, the person that took me to my first 12-step meeting was David Bowie. I was working with David Bowie, and he walked me into a meeting, which was a bit of a surreal experience.
Yeah. Well, if David Bowie takes you to the AA, you know there's something.
Well, he was sober.
He was sober
at the time. Yeah, he was 6 months sober, and we were doing a video in Ireland, and one of the members of his band, I think it might have been his drummer, I can't remember, was about 14 years sober.
Wow.
So I was a good project during this pop video, and anyway, I got sober, and the thing I found very interesting about getting sober was my background was. I was sent to a Catholic boarding school when I was a child, and it was the stuff of novels.
Mm.
I wasn't a Catholic, and it was shut down. It should have been shut down a long time before it was actually shut down, but it was highly abusive and inappropriate. And one of the things was that the priest would make me stand up every day in class and would tell me that I would burn in hell forever and no self-respecting Catholic would speak to a Protestant. But
wow.
I would drink and smoke in his apartment at night.
Okay.
So he was naughty. He was known as the kissing bandit. Luckily, he only liked three-year-olds at the time.
Oh,
one
God.
Was vastly relieved that he only liked three-year-olds. Of course, in hindsight, it was just horrific.
Yeah.
What was going on. And so by the time I got into 12-step recovery, 12-step recovery it's not specifically a religious program, but then again, at the same time, it is. It says it's a spiritual program, but you've got all these, you go to AA meetings and NA meetings and Gamblers Anonymous and Debtors Anonymous, and everything's got the 12-step. And unless they're enlightened, they've got God as a man, he. and I didn't have a very good relationship with God as a man.
Mm.
And I still really don't. I mean, I don't. And I think that what was interesting about early recovery was trying to find a way to have some sort of spiritual life that wasn't male defined, which is sort of odd, because actually I think most people take for granted and don't really think about it.
If you've been brought up in a Judeo-Christian society, then the idea of the patriarchal God is inbuilt into that system.
Yes, and I think we live in a patriarchal society anyway. And so one of the things that I found kind of interesting about sobriety is, you know, you get to a certain point of the 12-step recovery and you're asked to have a spiritual you're asked to be on a spiritual program. What the hell is a spiritual program? Define spiritual. I don't know what spiritual is.
Mm.
So I read everything. I read and I read and I read about all the different religions. I read all the different gurus. And I had originally this female spiritual teacher. So I already had this thing that had happened to me that had been very profound at the time, and she was a very, very clever teacher. And then I'm in this program that's kind of everything's with God, isn't what he says and he says and God says and he says, and this whole thing that was based on sort of shame and sin, and you've got a disease and you're a bad person,
yeah.
Which I've really struggled with.
Yeah.
So when yoga came along, The way that I met yoga was I was photographing nomads in Gujarat, like you do.
I got sober
and nobody in the film industry would work with me once I got sober because nobody believed I was sober. It was fine. I lost everything. And then I lost everything and then I got burgled. So then I really lost everything. And I just bought a flat and then Margaret Thatcher put the interest rates up to 19%. And then I really, really lost everything. So I was burgled.
Wow.
I lost my career.
In the same space
I had
of
to
a few months.
Oh, in the same about 3 months I lost everything and I got sober. And so I just everything. I ended up living in a bedsit in Balham.
Yeah.
And that was an interesting process of just a complete sort of deconstruction of the self. Everything went. I had nothing. I had no nothing. And it was cool. It was good. It's not the only time it's happened in my life, but it was an interesting point. And then you find yourself sitting in meetings going, I don't do this religion thing and I don't get where am I supposed to go? How do I find something that I can relate to as a woman? I'm a strong woman. I've had all these experiences. I've been very badly behaved. Mm. I'm definitely naughty. There's no question I'm naughty. Mm. And I can't fit into any of this. So does that mean I'm just sort of left wandering the hinterlands of the outside of society because I'm an ex-drug addict, an alcoholic and a gambler and I've had all these experiences? And so to kind of to change my career, I decided, okay, I want to be a photographer anyway, so that's fine. I went to India and I went to India to photograph nomads. I thought that was a good project. I got to India and I realized I didn't know where to find nomads. But anyway, I got pointed to the nomads, ended up in Gujarat, photographed, working with this fantastic prince actually up in a state. I just ended up in this place and he drove me in trucks with nomads and shepherds, and I photographed all these nomads, did this amazing project. Last day that we were there, never saw a white person, was in areas of India where they never have seen white people.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it was a very strange experience up in the marshes and the salt flats. It was an amazing experience.
This is early
90s? This is in the 95, yeah. And so I was in, got on about the last day, got into a truck to go and see some nomads, and these two white people got in to this truck, and you're kind of sitting there thinking, where did you come from? And she was a stockbroker from Rotherhithe, and he was a secret policeman. We didn't draw breath. She and I didn't draw breath for about 6 hours while we went to see Wild Asses. It was a very surreal experience. Came back to London, and she was a Kundalini yoga teacher. We started a Kundalini yoga class in my house. I can't tell you how much I hated it. I mean...
I thought you were going to say the exact opposite right now.
Yeah, I know. I absolutely hated it.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, I hated
it. It is quite a divisive practice.
Well,
I've introduced people to it or took people to classes or even taught a few myself, and sometimes people just look at you like you're crazy.
I think it's interesting. I mean, I got sober. I'm one of those people that drank to forget.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got sober, I knew exactly what I was trying to forget. And that was quite depressing and that was quite difficult.
Mm.
And I started drinking when I was 11 and I got sober when I was 31. And I had quite a lot I really needed to forget. And I found it quite difficult being sober. I found the spiritual path a complete nightmare. I mean, how do you make sense of it? And why does this person have to be a man? Why does God, So finally I end up in these yoga classes. And at the beginning I really hated it because at the time I was a runner.
Okay.
I used to go running. That's how I managed my emotions.
Yeah.
And we'd sit there and we'd listen to these fucking mantras and listen. I mean, just drive me bananas. But bit by bit, I'm kind of thinking, this is really weird. I hate this, but I feel better.
Yeah.
I really hate this, but I feel better. And then the teacher, then she said, let's, we're going to do a teacher training. Why don't you train? I thought, I don't want to be a yoga teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she said, just do the training because it's interesting. Do the training because it's interesting. And maybe we could run the training at your house and maybe you could cook for it because this is the first ever European teacher training. Why don't we do that? So I thought, okay, fine, I'm a good cook. Let's do that. So we did. And here I am 20 years later, I'm still teaching it, but I am very much a deconstructionist.
Yeah.
Kundalini yoga teacher. I definitely know I'm not a Sikh.
I really appreciate that because one of the things that put me off it a lot was the kind of slight feeling of indoctrination. Like,
yeah, I have no interest in it.
Yeah.
I think everybody should read Krishnamurti. Have you read Krishnamurti?
Yes, I have read some Krishnamurti.
And I think when you have your brain taken apart like that, you can't put it back together again in the same way. And then I think you look at things and you just think, no, I don't want that. I don't like it like that. I don't believe that. And therefore, let me look at it differently. And if I don't think anything of it, I'll walk away. But 20 years with Kundalini, I'm still playing it. But I'm still playing with it and it still expands, but I definitely do not. I don't want to be a Sikh. I don't want to be a Catholic. I have Jewish blood. I don't want to be a Protestant. I don't want to be a Hindu. I don't want to be any of those things.
Exactly.
I don't want to be any of those things. I can totally and utterly respect every single one of those people and their need for that thing. I can, but it's not what I'm interested in. My spiritual practice is completely different.
And that's often the case with a lot of spiritual paths, is that they want to put you in the box. They want to put you in their box and make you, or, you know, convince you that their way is the way.
No, I think there's another way to look at it.
Okay.
I think that quite a lot of people come to these spiritual practices because they need to climb out of their shame mm-hmm. by feeling like they're being good.
Okay.
And I think that if a practice is very defining, I think that if you have within the practice that you can prove how good you are, then you can potentially mask or get rid of your shame.
Ah, interesting.
And I don't believe that you really get rid of your shame, because no. I think that if you're in a hierarchical system that needs you to judge other people, you're still ashamed. And I think that if you come from suffering and if you come from abuse and addiction or whatever, I don't believe in addiction as a disease. So I think the roots of addiction are trauma, abuse and shame. Mm-hmm. And I think that if that's your background, I think that you have a motivating force in you that either needs you to shame other people and make yourself feel superior, or you give away all your power to somebody else to whom you need to prove that you're good enough. Mm-hmm. And then within that hierarchy, you climb up. I probably haven't described it very well, but I know what I mean.
No, I kind of understand what you mean.
And I'm also not interested in that. And I think also that the hierarchy, particularly, you know, some of these things, they ask that you keep moving up in the hierarchy. And then if you move up in the hierarchy, your ego is invested in your position in the hierarchy. And then you actually lose your voice, and then you can only become one of them.
And also your position in the group. Because there's a kind of request for you to adopt a certain way of life living or certain practices that maybe aren't what you want to, that you don't feel are appropriate for you.
I think it takes, I tried it out, you know, I've been doing it for 20 years.
Yeah.
I tried it out. I had small children. I was in a marriage that wasn't going brilliantly. I tried it out because it helped me feel safe. Mm. But then there comes a point where you go, this doesn't work. And that bit doesn't work. Mm. And I definitely don't like that bit. And I really don't like that bit. And I have absolutely no interest in that. But all of this I really like. And I've done that. And so, I think it takes courage to do that.
Oh, I think it's massive courage. But it's also, in that particular world, it's discouraged to do such a thing from my perspective.
It is. But you see, I'm not a lead trainer. I've always refused to be one. And also, I'm one of those people that brings an enormous amount of people to Kundalini Yoga because of the YouTube and the videos and how I teach and where I teach. So a lot of people come to Kundalini because of me. And I think that, you know, in all these years of being there and being at the yoga festival, I think that they are very aware of the importance of the spread of, you will have very, very diehard fundamentalists. And I think that somebody like me bookends that.
Sure.
And I think that I really appreciate how much space I'm given as a teacher. And I'm not the only one who is not conformist. There are several of us. And I think that you need to be able to encompass the breadth of it. And yeah. I think that I really appreciate the fact that I've never been told off or threatened or rejected. Okay. Or, you know, and I'm a good teacher and I'm a respected teacher, and I respect them as much as I feel they respect me. And okay, sometimes it all rubs the wrong way, but it doesn't really matter. We all deal with each other very well.
I get the feeling that you wouldn't really care anyway.
I mean, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? When I'm not a yoga teacher, I'm a sex therapist and a psychotherapist and a trauma therapist. And it's really important that I need to be able to sit in a room, even with 50 people, and say, yes, you know, you're a Hindu, you're a Muslim, you're a Catholic, you're this, you're that. These are your sexual rules. Those are your sexual rules. You're a fetish, you're trans, you're gay, yeah. you're whatever.
Yeah.
And absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. And I can't, it's not my job to make a judgment. Mm-hmm. But it is my job very much to accept myself.
And to be true to yourself.
Yes.
So if the voice in you says, well, I want to experiment with this in the way I teach, or in the way I, what I bring to a class, I'm going to, you know, bring this into it, or that aspect of myself into it, rather than just put on the faceless suit and robot out, you know, the same old stuff.
Well, I think, no, I mean, I think there are some very, very, you know, I think there are a lot of very potent teachers. I think there's a lot of great teachers. Mm. But I think that, I think what can sometimes happen is that the teacher can become a mouthpiece for someone else. And I think that that's a problem. And I think that that's sad if somebody hasn't got enough sense of themselves to bring themselves into it. And I think, I certainly, as a teacher, play with the technology.
Yes.
I play with the technology. And also, you know, when if I'm still answering your question, what brought me to yoga? Or was that the question exactly?
Yeah.
You know, with a background of being an addict, with a background of trauma and shame, then I think there's an enormous amount of freedom in being able to interpret posture and breath and that relationship to the divine in a way that is potentially more feminist, or in a way that is potentially more open-minded, or in a way that would potentially open up the inquiry into, if 52% of the world is female and if 52% of the world decided they want a spiritual practice, what would that spiritual practice be? Mm-hmm. What actually feels good? Because if all you're doing is what a man tells you to do, then you don't have a man's body. You have a different body. You don't have a man's thought process. You have a different thought process.
Hormones.
You don't have a man's hormones. You don't have a man's place in the world. You don't have, I mean, I'm privileged. I'm an independent woman. I'm a single parent. I have a lot of privileges. And I name single parent as a privilege. I'm privileged because I'm intelligent, I'm educated, I'm successful. I have a lot of privileges, mm-hmm. but I'm still a woman living in a patriarchy.
Sure.
And I think that as a teacher, one of my privileges is to be able to say, when you do this breath, or when you move in this way, or when you can do X, Y, Z with this and that, and this is what this posture does, then anyone can sit back and go, I like that.
Yeah, it's translating,
that feels,
isn't it?
Really,
it's
like, nice. And it's not about, you need to do this because somebody else said you need to do this. Uh-huh. Do this because maybe this will make this change. Mm. And I think that's really interesting.
And giving people the choice as well. You know, like it's kind of like, you know, how does it feel for you? You know, what works for you? That kind of
yes, thing. And I think also, you know, I know teachers who, you know, they're famous for the fact that they don't define anything. They don't say anything. They just say, do this, you know, do this posture, do that posture, do this breath, do this meditation. And you're just meant to sort of sit there and go, oh, God, you're so fantastic. Look how I feel. I wonder what I feel. Why do I feel like this? Mm. Okay, I do it the other way around. This is an interesting posture. This posture will affect your orgasm. It will affect your pelvic floor. It will affect your responsibility. It will do this. It will do that. And then I think what happens is people in the room go, oh, actually, I would like the idea of that. I will do this posture. I will choose to do this without meeting it through suffering. I will meet it through the sensations and see what that feels like.
Sure. And the practicality of that, you know, it's kind of like, if you do this, you might feel like this. This could happen. It could open this for
you. Yeah.
You know, it's very direct in a sense, but also quite gentle. Like I said, it feels like... It's not being forced upon you. It's like it's an offering.
Yes, and I think the thing that I like about yoga, it's a very good medium to enable and empower. And for me, that moment of lying on that 2 meter by 60 centimeter coffin of a piece of rubber, which is a bit like lying in your coffin, it's a very sacred space. It's very much your space. You can have 50-something people in a class and every single one of them is in their space. Yeah. I have quite big classes.
Yeah.
And they're each in their, that is their space in that room. That's, they own that space in that room. They sit on that mat. They put their things around it. They create their world. And then I think what's very interesting about teaching yoga is to be able to say, okay, this is your space. This is your world. How do you feel in it? You own this space in this time. And now notice how you've made yourself feel. And now recognize that what was the bit that you liked the most, take that and do it at home. Mm-hmm. And then gradually the experience of yoga, the experience of playing with what you name as the Kundalini, because I don't think that the Kundalini is relative to Kundalini yoga. particularly. I think the Kundalini is creativity.
Sure. This is something that I was hoping we'd that would come up, really, because it's a fascinating area. And I know a lot of people who, when I've said that I was coming to talk to you, that this is an area that people are really interested in, because it's kind of, it's quite a magical thing. And, you know, from me, when I was in my own years of getting really interested in all these kind of spiritual technologies, and Kundalini's just got this kind of, it's a bit magical. When you say the word Kundalini, people go, ooh, Kundalini. And it's got this like mystery. The idea that there is this latent energy that you can awaken is such a kind of attractive idea, really. You know, it's quite, it has a certain draw to it, I'd say. So when you're saying the Kundalini, Kundalini yoga is a form of yoga which the aim of it is to raise your Kundalini, which, for people that don't know, is the name given in Indian, is it in Hindu? I guess it's in the
Hindu tradition. The Kundalini is the curl of the hair of the beloved. Yes,
and sometimes,
but it doesn't only exist in the Hindu tradition.
Sure, and this is the interesting thing, where it's kind of it's cross cultural, it's cross. It comes up in Tibetan Buddhist stuff, all sorts of stuff, different kinds of.
Comes up in Christianity.
Ah, okay.
In Christianity, it's the Holy Spirit.
The Holy Spirit is what is Kundalini.
Yeah.
Ah, I like that.
So do I. So do I. And that's why I think it's so interesting. Why does it have to just be assigned to this one place? Go, yes. But let's pretend that you and I are just sitting looking out of a window into the Renaissance.
Okay.
To me, that is the Kundalini absolutely liberated.
Mm.
The carving, the paintings, the buildings, the clothes, the jewellery. Everything. I mean, the creativity. I mean, I know, you know, I was about to say, let's be the Medicis, and then I thought, let's not. but the Kundalini is this, it's creativity unleashed. It is actually the divine in the body. The Kundalini is the divine in the body. Now I don't personally believe that the divine is Hindu, nor do I believe that the divine is Sikh, nor do I believe that the divine is Christian. I think that the divine is all of our possibility and all of our potential. And I think you can be the most fabulous flower arranger, just as you can be the best yogi.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that when you sit on a mat, I think what's interesting about Kundalini yoga and how I interpret it is that when you sit on a mat, and if you know how to neutralize the nervous system, yeah? I'm a trauma therapist, so I know how to neutralize the nervous system. So you neutralize, you come out of the stress hormones.
Yeah.
You sit on the mat, you come out of, you do the things that take you out of the stress hormones. And then bit by bit, you waken up the nervous system to function to its full capacity.
Mm.
And for that person or that body, whether it's you or me or a whole room full of people, to actually then engage with and experience themselves as completely present, then you're playing with quantum physics.
Mm.
Then you're playing with something really interesting, which transcends the mundane. And I don't care whether you
and
name
it. And transcends the school that it came from or the...
Well, it transcends everything, because actually everything... I mean, you think about how we live now. We're never asked to be in our bodies. I mean, who's ruling the world at the moment? Mm. Google, Amazon, Apple... and Android or whoever.
Donald Trump.
Well, I mean, no, but, you know, we're asked to abandon ourselves all the time. And actually, when you know how to switch all of that off, and you know how to land into yourself, and you know how to become completely present, and then from there to play with possibility, then anything is possible. And I think that's what the Kundalini is. And I think the Kundalini exists outside of sitting on a mat.
Oh, yeah, completely.
But a mat is a great way of becoming present. Sitting on a mat and breathing and stretching allows you to break the contraction with this reality. You have this terrible contracting that literally contracts the body and the mind into the kind of cultural objectives and subjectives that we live in. And when you do some of these postures and some of these breath manipulations, you become a field of much more possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yes, of course, yeah. And who doesn't want to experience that kind of thing?
You ask that question. Lots of people don't.
Maybe not consciously, or maybe it's something that they can't conceive of. Or they haven't even...
Not everybody wants to do yoga, and I don't think everybody should do yoga, and lots of people don't feel like they're suited to it at all. But you can also get people who come to yoga and just go, well, actually, I just want to do Bikram. I just want to look at myself in the mirror.
But then that also ties into the idea that, you know, there is no one path. Everyone's an individual, and everyone has their own way of discovering their own divinity.
Yeah, I mean, I think where the rebel in me comes out is I'm not interested in assigning my liberation or creativity or awakening or awareness to any kind of intercession.
What do you mean by intercession?
What is intercession? You tell me what's intercession.
Are you talking about some sort of something coming in?
Well, a priest is an intercession, isn't it?
I mean, an intermediary.
A priest comes along and says, you want to know God, come to my church.
Sure.
And the next priest says, no, you want to go, come to my church. And then you have yoga teachers or lead trainers or gurus who say, you want to do it? It's like this. Yeah. Dress like this, go ding, 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 wear this on your head.
Exactly.
Hold your mala like this. You know, why do you get to moderate who I am?
Yeah. But then it becomes a system of control.
Well, I think it depends on how much you give away. And I think when you say who wouldn't want that experience,
given
lots of people do want it to be defined by the other, and they don't want to take responsibility for it.
Okay.
And I think that's where it's interesting. Mm. I think there's a lot of giving, there's a lot of abnegation of responsibility to somebody else to define what the experience is and the possibilities of that experience and the edges of that experience. I'm more interested in what would it be if you could be anything you wanted?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, if you've only got one leg, don't dream of being a footballer. I mean, try to be realistic, but I'm not interested in being a guru or you know, I'm just interested in going, try this.
Yeah.
This is the way. This is through this door, there are all these possibilities.
Yeah, and it's the thing of this has worked for me. So maybe it'll work for you.
I think there's an integrity there that is.
I mean, that it's based in something that you've been through and that you've found useful. You know, that's how all teaching really starts, really, isn't it? It's you have an experience of something that helps you work through whatever you need to work through at the time. And then you are able to then hopefully maybe you can then share that in some form in the future once you, if you feel to, you don't have to, I guess, but... you know, even if you don't call yourself a formal teacher, you know, everyone's a teacher, really. And I think everyone's got wisdom and knowledge to offer in that sense. But yeah, going back to just what you were saying about the intermediaries and the intercession, it definitely, I think that ties into societal construction and what you were talking before about, you know, patriarchal control and that kind of thing. People, it takes a lot for people to think for themselves.
And lots of people don't want to. I mean, that's why, but that's interesting. So let's go in a full circle back to where we began. If you look at and I can't remember if we were recording that part of the conversation, but look at Kundalini as a construction, Kundalini yoga, you know, white turbans, all of that background. A lot of people do want to be led. And a lot of people do want to be told, and a lot of people do want to join a hierarchy that lets them feel safe and means that they don't have to think for themselves.
Do you think that's just part of a, if you zoomed out from that, would that look like just the middle part of a journey, you know? Is it that kind of, it feels to me like that's almost something that people might need to go through to come out the other side.
I don't know. I think it's an interesting question, because if I think about things like 12-step recovery, if you get into long-term 12-step recovery, and you may not know anything about it, but 12-step recovery can it's a life-changing thing to get sober. I mean, to go through 12-step, it's an amazing support. I don't agree with the disease model, but I think that the 12-step recovery support program is an amazing thing. I think peer recovery is an extraordinary thing. And I wish it would update itself to be more peer-led around the fact that maybe recovery is about coming out of trauma and shame and abuse rather than saying you have a disease. And that's okay. Nobody's asking me my opinion, but that's what I think. But my point is that if you go through that as your background, then your bones in your body feel like they're held in place by these rules that say, you know, once an addict, always an addict. Mm. You know, the first drink will kill you. You know, you've got these rules that are set in your brain. And so then...
Well, that's doctrine, isn't it?
It's doctrine, and on one level that keeps you sober. And if that keeps you sober, and if keeping you sober keeps you alive, then that's a bloody marvellous thing.
True.
And I know people who have, you know, been Kundalini Sikhs for almost all their adult life. And it's been an identity, and they have created an entire reality based around that. You know, just as I may have created my entire reality around being, a feminist, open-minded, blah, 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 with all the bits that I attach to that. I think we make identities to create safety. And I think that really where the courage comes is sometimes you actually have to have the courage to take those identities apart and go, actually, that bit doesn't work for me. I'm going to flick it away.
Yeah.
That bit doesn't work for me. If I take those bits away, who am I? And I think that one of the things that we can do is reject an enormous amount.
Yeah.
And I could have rejected all of that, but actually, no, I think there's an amazing amount of stuff in it that's fantastic. There's just certain bits that I won't do.
Sure.
And that then means that, yes, I tread an interestingly rebellious path, and at the same time, I'm allied to something which is quite hierarchical, quite systemic.
Mm.
But I'm free, and I'm able, with an enormous amount of respect both ways, to interpret it. And that interpretation seems to be okay.
Yeah, I mean, so you should be, but I think my feeling was, you know, I've done a teacher training in that school. And
have you?
Yes.
Who did you teacher train with?
I did a teacher training with, I can't remember what they call it now, Iksarandian or something like that. Her name, the teacher's name is Ishwara.
Oh, yes. So that was a Carter Singh training?
No, they have their own school now.
Okay, yeah, I know who you mean then.
And Kirpal is her partner.
Yep.
So I did a training with them, which left me with mixed feelings regarding some aspects of it. And I still feel like that way. And also one of the things that I felt was the discouragement of questions and the discouragement of trying to get answers about things which there were no answers for. Which I then had to go and research myself and come into contact with other people. And I ended up becoming friends with a guy who was one of the original members of the ashram in the States when Yogi Bhajan went over there. And he saw everything, you know, as it happened at the start. And he was there from the beginning. And he's got a fascinating outlook on all that stuff. And he wrote a couple of books about it, actually. Really interesting guy. But it just made me, the lack of questioning, the lack of being open to questioning, and then being shut down by spiel.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that. And I know that happens. And I know that that's what a lot of people complain about in the teacher trainings. But, you know, what I would say now is people come to me and say, oh, my God, please, can you run it? Please, can you run it? Please, can you run level one? And I just think, no, I don't want to, because I don't ever want to run a level one, because I don't want... I'd much rather be the person that you come to because you want your mind open afterwards.
But that's where I see your place in this whole kind of thing as being so valuable and so important, because a lot of the, like my experience with the teacher training was I came out of it feeling like, yes, the technology has tremendous application, but the rest of it can just...
But it's a pity that you've been frazzled by that aspect, because it's an interesting thing to explore in a way, that moment that where... I don't know how to put it.
Mm. But what I was... Sorry, Karin.
No, go on.
What I was trying to get at really is that... If there were more people with your angle on this in that world, then I would have felt more at home in being able to be open and just ask questions about things. And well, why do I have to do this? Or what's the proof of this? You know, this such and such. It felt very discouraged, like I said. So I feel like if there were more people who had that approach that you bring. Which is a bit more deconstructed, and it's, to be honest, it feels evolutionary. Like things change, and you need to be open to incorporating newness into things. Otherwise, you know.
I think you're right, and I think that I think that now, when people say to me, "Which teacher training should I do?" I think there's some of them that are great, and others I wouldn't touch with a barge pole. Mm. And I have specific ones I will recommend always.
Mm.
And I will not run my own level one, even though I have been asked to and asked to and asked to. And I will always say, go and do it. If you're having problems, talk to me. Take what you need from it.
Mm.
But don't let it make you feel that you're cursed. Just take what you need from it and then let's move forward. And yeah. then, you know, come and work with me and let's move forward. I think of the teacher training as being, imagine that you and I are sitting and we can smell in the room the most glorious melon you've ever seen in your life. I mean, it's so beautiful, the melon. It's fantastic. You can, the perfume of this melon, it's grown in the sun. It's
I'm grown, salivating.
Yeah, this melon is beautiful. And imagine that I'm holding in my hand a green-handled melon scoop.
Okay.
Yeah? You know mm-hmm. that kind of half circle yeah. with a hole?
Yeah.
And it's going to make a melon ball. Cut the melon open, the smell and the juiciness of this melon. I'm going to take this melon scoop and I'm going to scoop out one ball and I'm going to put it on your plate. That's what you're allowed to know on teacher training of Kundalini Yoga.
Yes.
And that's all you're allowed to know.
Yeah.
And that's okay. And you can stay with the safety of that being all, and that little thing sliding around that plate is, you're allowed to just know that. And lots of people only know that. And in only knowing that, they have edges, they have safety, they know what to wear, they know what they can't say, they know what they can't question. It's fine.
But then it's I'm really interested.
Well, that's okay. But it's very interesting because there's an enormous amount. You've still got all the rest of the melon. And I'm really interested in, yes, that's the ball, but then there's all the rest of the melon.
Yeah.
And that's a really interesting thing. And if it isn't defined by that one religious vision, what is it?
Mm.
If it isn't defined through the eyes of that one religious vision, what is it? It's absolutely massive. And that's really interesting, and that's really fascinating, and that's really completely exciting. And that's an extraordinary practice, which in 20 years, I haven't even begun to touch the sides.
But that's where it transcends the system and the group and the people that are, you know, even telling you things. That's where you start to internalize it or bring out your own interpretations.
But you see, you've got to have courage, haven't you?
Oh, tremendous.
Right. So because how can I imbue that, in you the courage to now go and pick up the melon and go and discover the rest of it?
I think I am doing that really in my own way, but there is a definite sense of that there's a potential for being, well, do you know what? I don't really care, to be honest.
Don't be disappointed.
No, but I think there is a definite sense of judgment from some spheres, or of you shouldn't be doing this, you're misrepresenting something that's not, you have no business misrepresenting, or who gave you the authority? But I would say, like, I have the authority to do what I want to do, really. You know, no one can tell me that I can't do something like that. So yeah, I don't think I'm lacking in that sense, but yeah, it's an interesting one anyway. Yeah, it's a good journey to be on. So, what I wanted to just touch on is that you talked about shame and trauma and addiction, and your concurrent work as a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just curious as to, was that inspired by the yoga work you were doing as you were opening up and kind of examining yourself? You felt the need to kind of study that, or how did that dovetail alongside your yoga practice?
It's an interesting question. I think I learned a lot about the mind. I learned a lot about managing the mind. I learned a lot about the breath and the body. And then I've always been very interested in posture. I'm kind of like an expert on posture and hormones. And then bit by bit, more and more people came and started talking to me. And I'm also long-term, 26 now, 26 years sober.
Mm.
So a lot of recovery. But I also battled against this kind of hierarchy of recovery as well, and eventually decided that training as a therapist would be the way forward. And what was very interesting about all the years of being a yoga teacher, when I started to train as a therapist, I was turning up on trainings and turning up on therapy trainings, and you know, nobody gives a fuck about who you are as a yoga teacher. Well, I don't care who you are or what you know. I'm not interested. It means nothing.
Yeah.
You know, and there's this weird perception of yoga. I suppose, I don't know, it's like that Instagram thing, isn't it? Or Facebook, you know, what people think I do, what I do and what people think I do.
Mm.
You know, a lot of people look at yoga and think, well, you're just standing on a mat doing stupid postures, but we're doing something really important. And I think that's fine. But it was an interesting deconstruction of the self to go on these trainings, and nothing I knew or thought as a yoga teacher meant anything mm-hmm. at all. None of my experience meant anything. And that was fine. And so it was kind of several years of different sorts of trainings, you know, psychosexual trainings and trauma trainings and couples trainings and all these things I've done, where it doesn't matter. We don't care. We're not interested in anything you think. Because like with the Kundalini teacher training, they've got to teach me what I need them to know, what they need me to know.
Yeah.
So I go on a Kundalini training, they need to teach me what they need me to teach me. I go on a therapy training, specified therapy training. They have a job to make sure they don't care what I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really interesting thing to know, is they really don't care what I think. They need to tell me certain things. And so that was fine. I did all the training. And then what started to happen is I managed to make bridges. And once I started to make bridges, then the bridges didn't stop.
Now, that's very interesting,
yeah.
Because that's where I think this kind of grows beyond, and this is where the creativity, or your creativity, and what you're kind of honouring in yourself comes through, because you have these different aspects and you're bringing them together,
yeah.
Rather than saying, no, this is my practice and I, there isn't room for the other parts of me, or, you know.
Well, if I was a fully signed up Kundalini yoga as taught by Yogi Bhajan Sikh person, because that's the interpretation of what it should be now. It's not how it was interpreted 20 years ago. Then I wouldn't be allowed to say, I wouldn't allow myself to say 99.999% of even the things I've said today. That would be out of bounds. And whatever I thought about sex would be defined by what he'd say. Mm-hmm. Whatever I thought about pregnancy would be defined by what he'd said. Mm-hmm. Whatever I thought about addiction would be, well, that to me is bollocks.
And that's the model.
And
that
it's not
they,
what he said was bollocks, but
yeah.
No, what he said was what he said, and fantastic.
Yeah.
But it's only a view.
Sure.
And then I have my view, and then there's a different view, and then there's a different view. And let's look at it from lots of different views. So I can now, as a Kundalini yoga teacher with who I am, say, well, actually, I'm also an addiction therapist. Let's do an addiction class. I'm a trauma therapist. Let's do a workshop on trauma. Let's bring Kundalini yoga in, because it'll really help.
So how did you find, how did you make the links with the yoga or the kriyas or whatever particular aspects? Was it very intuitive for you to say, right, okay, I feel drawn to do some work around addiction. So I have a feeling that this particular posture, because it works on such and such a gland.
Can I whisper something to you that nobody else can hear?
Yeah, no one's listening.
Okay. I don't believe that if I change a kriya, I will burn in hell forever.
Shh, you're not allowed to say that.
Well, and anyway, if I'm going to go to hell, it won't be for this. So I was given the original teachings as a gift by somebody who died a couple of years ago.
Uh-huh.
And also I've always worked and taught a lot of the Guru Singh work, which isn't the same as what...
Who's Guru Singh?
Who's Guru Singh?
Are you talking about Sant Hazara Singh?
No, I'm talking about Guru Singh, who's an amazing teacher in Los Angeles. GuruSingh.com. He's brilliant. He's the most eloquent, elegant, hilariously funny Kundalini yoga teacher. He's a master, and he is also a rebel, and he was one of my first teachers. And I teach a lot of his stuff.
Ah, okay.
And he's always made up his own series.
Mm.
And I will change series.
Yeah. Well, I mean, from what I understand, that's kind of what Yogi Bhajan did.
Yeah, he made
people
it up as well.
Want to, people don't want to know that, or they don't want to accept that, if that's the
but
case.
But I mean, I don't want to get into a critique of Yogi Bhajan, because it's not about that. But I'm,
but
I
just,
feel
it's
totally
just transparency,
free.
Really.
Yeah, no, I feel completely free to be able to say I'm going to use this series because it works very well with something I'm saying about this. Mm. Now, this series might be by Guru Singh. That series might be by Yogi Bhajan. That series might be an interpretation of Yogi Bhajan by Guru Ratanakar.
Mm-hmm.
Or that series might be, I'm actually going to put those three postures with that posture. I don't necessarily make up series, I don't. But, you know, if I'm working particularly with karma, I might use those three very good karmic postures that work really well.
Mm.
Or if I'm doing a series on anger, I may well put together a series of postures, which I'm not saying it's a yoga set, but these four postures are fantastic.
Sure.
Post a shame circle. I do a lot of work with shame.
Mm.
Now do this posture. Now do that posture. Now do that posture. And then we'll have cleared all that energy.
Mm.
So I'm, you know.
But that's fantastic. That's, you know, that's kind of how it should, you should be. Anyone should be free to do that.
And nobody's stopping you.
Nobody is stopping
you.
But
just as equally, lots of people like the rigor and they feel safe with
the
rigor.
Sure. And there's an element of, like I alluded to before, I think there is an element of Oh, you do that? Like, there's a kind of...
I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, exactly. That's what's so great. And that's what, you know, that's what's so empowering, I think, especially for people that have been into this for a long time and had the opposite approach pressed onto them. So your work as a therapist has evolved alongside your yoga.
Yes, and in certain ways of thinking, particularly around addiction. I mean, I know that I'm part of a growing school of thought that really doesn't believe that addiction is a disease at all. And I don't believe in sex addiction. I'm one of the therapists that I don't believe in sex addiction. I'm sorry, but you have behaviour patterns that will find different ways to manifest themselves, and a lot of people will divert into sexual anxiety using porn and all that sort of stuff. And society does not want you to be present. Society wants you to be completely dissociated. So as a therapist meeting yoga, as a trauma therapist meeting yoga, as an addiction therapist meeting yoga, it's a marriage made in heaven. And it works very well for me. I find that it works very, very well for me. And I know I'm not a traditional Kundalini yoga teacher, but I think that if anyone walks in the room and sees me, they know that too. And if that's what they want, they'll walk straight out.
Yeah.
And if they're willing to open their mind, they'll stay and they'll listen. And then sometimes I'll mentor them. I'm just starting supervision for Kundalini yoga teachers to help them hold themselves, whether they're fundamentalist Sikhs, whether they're open-minded. And they can be Sikh and open-minded. I mean, I'm not defining anything as being negative at all. But I think it's important that yoga teachers are supported in their daily work, because it's not an easy thing to hold yourself. It's not an easy thing to hold yourself long-term as a teacher. Certainly 20 years of teaching, I have now trained my therapeutic supervisors to oversee my work as a teacher, and it's life-changing. Because it's a difficult thing to hold yourself.
Yeah, completely.
In the face of anxieties around what are you saying, what are you doing, in the face of judgments, in the face of the whole body insanity that's going on. So I think, I don't know where the conversation's going now, but I think being a teacher is an interesting thing.
Well, I'd kind of like to just move into talking a little bit about shame.
Okay.
That's because it seems to you the path we're going down at the moment is just kind of going that way to me. And there's a teacher that I've worked with recently. She's American. She's nothing to do with yoga. She does. She's kind of into practical magic, if you will. She talks a lot about shame as being the key to great part of personal transformation, and the part that holds people, that really holds people back often, is this part where, you could call it the Jungian shadow aspects of yourself that you don't want people to know about, you don't want to share. And her approach is based around, well, find all those bits that make you squirm and all the bits that you don't want anyone to know, and then, you know, share them, amplify it, you know, make it big, bring it out, you know, own the fact that you're an imperfect human, that you're selfish, that you have moments where you're not spiritual, where you're not, you know, humble, all this kind of, where it's at odds with sometimes with this kind of Instagram culture of presenting perfection or presenting, you know, do you know what I'm trying to say here? Like this kind of, this idea that it doesn't matter, I'm cool, you know, I'm not, it's not a problem. And then the flip side of that, where you bring out these kind of things and bring them into the light, you know, that has the effect of transforming them. And I just wondered if you, does that tie in with the way that you look at shame, and how do you, when you do your work with shame, how does that process kind of look for you?
No, it doesn't tie in with how I work with shame, not at all. And I think that is a way. I can see that that's a way. I think that shame is if there was a kind of arcana of difficult emotions to experience, I think shame would be the heaviest card in the pack. potentially apart from grief.
Yeah.
But I think shame is a really hideous experience of the self.
Mm.
And I think the ask that you can just magnify it and flip it, I don't believe that that does deeply work on shame. I think that, yes, I agree with your friend that to understand shame is, I think to work with your shame gives you the keys to the kingdom. But I do have a very different approach.
Okay.
A very, very different approach. And it's difficult to sort of encapsulate it in a couple of sentences. I work as a therapist with shame. And I work with posture with shame.
That's interesting. So how does that tie? How does that tie in?
Because shame is not just a mental process. Shame is a very, very physical experience, which is why it's so awful.
Mm-hmm.
But most of us don't cognitively connect to the fact that it's a physical sensation.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can work with the physical sensation, which is something I do. And I think also that...
So it's quite somatic, you're talking about.
Well, some of the work I do is somatic, but not all of it. But I mean, I work with posture and breath with shame very, very much. But I also work with helping people identify the core wounding, helping people to identify. So I can work one-to-one on shame, but I also run workshops, three-day workshops. And honestly, 2 days of it is the most hideous experience of the self that you probably have ever had.
Mm.
And it's not nice.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to sort of choose to be able to do it. You've got to say, yes, I want to go there, because it's not, you can't sit there and avoid it. You are going to feel hideous. So
it's quite brave people then that
sign
up for
those. Yeah, it's very brave people. It is very brave people. And nothing is the same again.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get what it is. And I think what's interesting about, you know, when we first came in the room that we're in here now, this is my therapy room. We're sitting in my therapy room. So it's a room that's painted very, very, very dark blue with this interesting north light. So to me, you know, you sit in here and you suddenly time disappears and the face looks like a painting. There's nothing to do with the, there are books and there's an, you know, there's lights, but essentially it's a timeless room. Time disappears. And there's something about being able to feel shame. There's something about allowing yourself to experience and name your shame, which is a very interesting thing. And in a therapy room, I sit with people one-to-one, and in a quiet room, we talk about these awful things. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody will tell me, not always something that's been done to them, it might be something that they've done or something that they've colluded in or behaviours that have been destructive. And there's something about the silence and the respectfulness that on a certain level is extraordinarily privileged. And on another level, I always think it's such a pity, because if this could come into a group work, this would move so fast. So I do these groups, but it would be a lie to say it's a pleasure.
Mm.
It's a really seriously hideous experience. But by the time you get to 2/3 of the way through the second day, you have the keys to the kingdom. And then the rest of it is the tools of how to manage it. And then from there, you are a different person. But to be able to hear, kind of lay out what I do.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, I know that I do very unique work and I do it very well. And it's very, I'm very heavily supervised in the work that I do. Mm. And I have worked with a supervisor now for 3 years, refining and refining and refining. I just recently took the workshop apart and put it back together again and completely and utterly changed it to something else.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's still a shame workshop, but it's now a very, very interesting thing. Shame is a terrible trigger for addiction. It's a terrible trigger for total abandonment of the self.
Mm-hmm.
It's a terrible trigger for the most awful, awful emotions. And the terrible truth about having shame is if you have shame, you will shame.
Mm-hmm.
And so the work is intense.
Yeah.
I feel like sometimes when I'm doing it, I feel like a sort of death eater.
Wow.
I feel, and I don't know what that means to you, Death Eater, but I feel like somebody that can hold a space that allows people to explore the worst of themselves. And in doing that, you leave with just so much more clarity. so much more clear. It's an amazing privilege to be able to do it.
But, I don't think there's many people that can do that.
No, and I don't think so either. And I think what you're describing from your friend is a specific level of it. But I don't fear going nine layers down into hell.
Sure, yeah. She's not working. She's not a therapist, and she's not working with people deep in trauma. Yeah. She's working with more surface level, more easier to transform. Let's
vulnerability
say.
Kind of
sure.
thing.
Sure. But what you're talking about is truly deep work.
Yeah, it is.
But it seems to me that this kind of stuff is so valuable, and so there's really not that much from what I can see anyway. Not that I've looked very deeply into this, but it doesn't feel like there other than traditional counselling routes that. These kind of intensive workshops as a way to deal with shameful things people might be experiencing?
No, there's not a lot. I know there's not a lot. I mean, I think it's a current fascination, but luckily I've been doing it for quite a long time. So,
are you finding that people, more and more people are finding this work?
Yes, I'm about to run my second workshop this year on it. And I have a lot of clients that I work with one-to-one.
Okay, so you're currently doing about two a year, is that? Or
it's possible that I may run another one later this year, depending on interest.
Is this where your kind of passion lies then at the moment?
My passion lies in working with, I'm fascinated by trauma. Mm. I'm fascinated by the effect of trauma. I'm fascinated by how hideously appalling it is to experience oneself if that is your background. Whether it's trauma, abuse, or shame, I think they all hold hands, and they all have incredible consequences in how we experience ourselves. And then, if I neatly loop back, one of the extraordinary ways through that is through the breath and with posture, when you understand how to use posture with that, which then means I don't define posture per se as a religious experience. But I will define it as a Kundalini experience, which at the same time will then also loop back to a religious experience as defined by Christianity or Hinduism or Judaism or the Tao, depending on whose lenses are looking at that energy. But I also think that if you're able to master and manage your emotion and your pain and your trauma, then you're an extraordinary person who has the keys to the kingdom. Mm. And then suddenly it becomes religious again. It's interesting, isn't it?
It's very interesting. There's all these kind of bridges and cross links like you were in.
Yeah, I play a lot with religious language because I think it's so linked into the depth and the pain. But I also think if I now come back and I take a slightly different view of this whole white thing, white view of the self,
okay,
as defined by white tantra or white wearing white as a Kundalini yoga teacher, I think the ask to give your head and to forget your past and not to be a person, I think that's a very strong shame trigger. And I certainly teach as a woman that you should embrace your darkness because that's where your power lies.
Completely.
That's where the gold is.
Completely.
And if you are running away and trying to come out of your lower triangle into your higher triangle, then your shame is going to chase you all the time.
And that's something that I've seen, a criticism that sometimes I've seen leveled at the yogic world is there isn't the addressing of that kind of darkness and the shadow aspects. Maybe in more tantric practices, but there seems to be a bit of a void there.
Not as far as how I teach.
But that's because you've generated your own way of working with that.
Well, also because I think that if I define, if I look at, it's a hard one to do without it being a visual thing, and we're not working in a visual way today because we're talking. But think about white. Think if you have white, you have white, you have Kundalini, you have white yoga, you have white tantra, you have this white aspect. Well, it's only half of the circle.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you're being asked to do is ignore the black.
Exactly.
Now, if the white is the right, yes?
Yes.
And the white and the right are male, and the white and the right are positive,
okay.
And the white and the right are defined as being the sun.
Okay.
And the white and the right and the male and the positive are defined as being the logical way. And the right way and the path out. Well, actually, that's the external creation and destruction of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And the internal creation and destruction of the universe is the left, is the darkness, is Kali. This right side is Shiva. The left side is Kali. It's the internal processes. It's your shame. It's your anxiety. It's your story. It's your history. It's your negative mind, your discerning mind. It's very interesting. It's the shadow side. And I think that you have to be able to have 360 degrees. And so if you're in a discipline that says 10 men said that and then this other guy said it and then you got these male teacher trainers, I think you're kind of missing 50% of the point.
Yeah.
So I definitely hold and teach from the other 50% as well as holding the other side. But I do think that you have to be able to have all of it. And I don't think that one can fear one's darkness. I think my job as a therapist or my job as a teacher or my job as a person is to empower people into, you know, shit happens and the rest is what you do with it.
Yeah, completely. It's just, it's common sense in
and
a
then
way.
your bad story, your painful story, your horrible story, your sadness, whatever it is you come from, which a shocking number of people come from. And admittedly, more people will go to yoga because they're trying to make sense of their story than perhaps the general public. So I admit that if I'm looking at the yoga community, it's going to have slightly more of its fair share of stories than maybe the general community. But you need to be able to turn poison into nectar. So you've got to go and look.
Alchemy.
Yeah, I like the alchemy. That's what I do.
Yeah, it's such a great metaphor, you know, because it's true.
But, you know, maybe one day you'll come on a teacher training or come on something. I don't run a level one, but you'll come and do something that I teach and you might find yourself with lots of bits going, oh, God, okay, yes, and yes, and yes, and bang, I get it. Okay, now that makes sense of that and that makes sense of that. I think it's about giving yourself permission. I like permission, you know, permission to be whoever you are.
Yeah.
If you came, you know, if I run workshops, a lot are on anxiety, a lot are on addiction, a lot are on shame, different ways of viewing the same problem through different lenses, sitting in a different place. I just did a workshop on the neutral mind. And to get to the neutral mind, we had to go through the negative mind, you know? And I think there's this very interesting thing of being able to sit in a room with a load of people going, okay, we come together because we're all insane. Now give you permission to be insane. And actually, that's very relaxing. Because you don't have to pretend to be anything other than who you are.
Yeah. Yeah.
We meet because we're all drug addicts, or we meet because we're all anxious, or we meet because we've all got shame. Yeah. Okay, we've all got shame, so now let's get on with it.
Yeah,
I don't need to pretend. You don't need to pretend. They don't need to pretend. And then the intimacy in the group is extraordinary because the social moderation is taken away that says you can't be anxious, you can't be unhappy, you can't be dark, you can't be this, you can't be that. No, we're all here because of it.
But again, that takes somebody who has been through their own shit and has incorporated that part of themselves, or has, you know, looked deeply into that other half, as you described it, to hold those spaces. And what I see a lot is that people who don't have that, or maybe it's not, I don't know, it's hard to tell, but for me, it feels like when you, it's part of why I appreciate what you do, because you're somebody that I can feel has that, you know, isn't scared of the darkness and isn't trying to pretend that it's all about the whiteness and it's all about the lightness. And
no, and I think if you run away from that, then you haven't got anything. You've just got a load of shame because you're dressed up in white pretending to be something, but you've run away from all the story. And I think you've got to have your story. Otherwise, who are you?
Yeah, it's like Carl Jung says about the great task. There's a quote, I can't quite remember, but he says about the great task of his life was about learning about his own personal myth, and learning to understand his personal myth and what that meant. And there's something in that that I quite like, without becoming overly attached to this kind of like identifying with this myth. Interesting. It's very interesting stuff, this. And I think there's not, like you said before, there seems to be a dearth of people who are holding these spaces. Maybe in those circles, it's more. Another part of my work over the years is a lot of shamanic work, and it feels that I've come from that place, and that's been very much about whatever comes up is whatever comes up, and it's all, everything's part of this. It's all accepted. It's all, you know, the darkness, the light, the everything's part of the journey, you know. which kind of work has really brought in that side to me of that going into those deeper, darker places, and which has been really valuable.
Mm.
How do you see your work evolving, or does it feel like, I mean, it sounds like you constantly evolve what you're doing and how you present it.
It seems to have its own evolution. I mean, I'm just setting up this supervision thing to support teachers, and I want now to write 3 books.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
So you've already got the 3 books.
I certainly know the first 3 books. Yeah, and I know where I want to start. I am also going to be starting more groups. So there'll be groups starting. I'm intending to start 4.
What do you mean by groups?
I think group work is very powerful.
Like circles?
Yeah, well, I've already been running. I've been running a group for female teachers for the last nearly year and a half, called For Whose Gaze Do You Stand? Gaze mean G-A-Z-E. So mm-hmm. Who's looking at you when you teach?
Mm-hmm.
Who are you? Whose voice are you using when you speak?
Mm-hmm.
And that's been an amazing experience of teaching and working with a group of people. And it's fantastic to witness what's happened. And I like group work. And I'm now trained as a group supervisor and in group work. And so I'm about to change my practice to encompass. I'll do different groups where I'm moving my practice to. So I think it's a continuous evolution. I mean, as a teacher, I don't just teach general classes normally. I have a focus in how I teach. My workshop work is going well. It just continues to evolve. And also I never stop practicing. I never stop studying, exploring, reading. So it has its own evolution. And then I think if you're doing that, you're kind of tuned into what's emerging and mm-hmm. can move with it, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. And there's the other side that we haven't even touched on today, the other things that you do, such as the photography, and I know you're quite interested in nutrition.
Yeah, I teach a lot about food, mainly through... I teach a lot about food, actually, because I run a pregnancy yoga teacher training.
Ah, right.
I run a pregnancy yoga teacher training called The Mother's Journey, which is big, actually, interestingly. And I also... teach
is that
about
something that you've designed yourself?
It's been running for over 10 years, yeah, since 2004. So, that's a long time, 13 years. I do that, Mother's Journey. And I also do the Mastering the Addictive Personality, where there's a lot about nutrition and food there as well.
Mm, it's such a key piece.
Yeah. I mean, then the addiction part, the addiction thing in recovery is very, very interesting. And the whole issue around eating disorders and all of that kind of clean eating thing is interesting. I can't remember what your question was, but yeah, I work with food. I work with nutrition. I think communication. I want to make more films. I want to set up a weekly class that I film that people can subscribe to.
Mm.
So I'm in the process right now of trying to make some quite deep changes in how I structure my day and how I structure my reality.
And the way that you can get the work that you're doing out to more people, perhaps. So using technology.
Yeah, I think I'd like to do books, but I will also. I've explored a lot. The whole nature of pay-per-view, and I think the one just gives it away.
Yeah.
I think I'd spend more money trying to set up pay-per-view and being found than I would ever make from people subscribing.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, one films it, gives it away, and that gets bums on seats.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way to do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I've done pay-per-view and I get like 5-6 buys. There's so much out there for free. I don't think there's any point trying to define it by... money.
Yeah, I think you're gating yourself off in these days.
You're getting what?
Gating yourself off a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, no, so I don't want to do that. So I think YouTube is a wonderful thing.
Mm.
I really do. And I get emails from people all the time and who've been watching my stuff all over the world. And I find that really extraordinary, the generosity of YouTube, which I know people object to, but I also find it extraordinary. So I think for me as a medium, it's fine. Mm. And I like teaching and I like being a therapist. So I'm happy with what I do. So I don't know where it's going to evolve, but I have plans.
I've no doubt at all that you have plans.
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah, yeah, it's been a pleasure to meet you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. And I've appreciated the space you have given me to explore.
Mm.
I hope I haven't been overtly horrid about anything or anybody. I certainly haven't intended to be.
I don't think you have at all. I think you've just been honest, which is what all I can ask, really.
Yeah.
And I really, like I said, I really value what you bring, the honesty and the integrity and the open-mindedness that you bring to the work that you share. And I do encourage people, if you don't know Carolyn's work, then please go and go to, what's your website?
CarolynCowan.com.
CarolynCowan.com. And you have a YouTube channel?
I have, yeah, my name. My name is Carolyn, C-A-R-O-L-Y-N, Carolyn Cowan. Yeah.
So, yeah, please, if any of this has pricked your ears up or pricked your heart up or pricked your soul up in any way, then please do go and explore some of Carolyn's works. I think there's some great depth there and some very valuable and much needed learnings and teachings going on. Yeah, thank you for your time.
That's nice of you, thank you.
Thank you for bringing your energy and your presence to the conversation today.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
So you've been listening to the Lumieres podcast with me, Jody. I deeply appreciate your time and attention as ever, and we should say thank you, as we always do, to Mr. Ben Chasney of Six Organs of Admittance, who provided the music which you hear at the very start and the very end of this podcast. And that track is called Light of the Light, and you can find that on his Asleep on the Floodplain record, which is on Drag City Records, which if you're on the internet and you want to go and find out more about those guys, that's dragcity.com. And if you go to sixorgans.com, that's Ben's website, you can hear some more of his wonderfully freakish folky music. For now, that's all from me. Have a great couple of weeks, and we'll be back soon with more.
We found hope.